My name is Judy Madison, and we're going to be talking today about how our lifestyle, individual lifestyle, can affect not only our own well-being, but that of people around the world. Every person counts is the title of the presentation. And I'm going to have to go like the wind, I think, to get it all in. Let me start with a prayer thought that I wrote some time ago. People say that the age of scarcity is coming. In some ways, I know it's already here. My friend can't get her carpeting order filled for months. I drive slower to save gasoline. I go without some favorite foods and fabrics. The future is uncertain, but I must live with change, and I must help my children adjust to change. It's no small task, Lord, to switch from convenient affluence to careful, even constrained buying and ownership. If I cannot drive to a movie, can I learn to enjoy something else? Can I be realistic about what is truly important, discard the frills and the sales pitches, the unnecessary indulgences? Can I be patient? I, always in a hurry. Can I learn to wait, to delay rewards? Lord, help me be less possessive of things, sensitive to the greater needs of others, truly poor, able to feel self-confident and worthy, even in plain clothes or small cars, or in simple homes and surroundings. Help me be patient with slower transportation, content, even glad to spend more time at home, creative in my use of things and resources and time, and able to stimulate in my children an appreciation for the good things in life, friends, family, outdoors, creativity, meditation, without trips to the dime store and restaurants and expensive entertainment. It's a big adjustment for self-indulgers like us. Help us, Lord, to adjust to the age of scarcity. Shall we pray? Lord, change is a difficult thing to take into ourselves. First, we must be of the mind to do it. Sometimes we are forced into it by external circumstances. In the days in which we now live and which are coming to us, help us learn to adjust to change in meaningful ways, consistent with our faith. Help us, Lord, to become less self-indulgent. Help us, Lord, to see the fullness of life as it includes all the world. Amen. The thing about that poem that I read to you, or the prayer that I just read to you, is that it's already 8 years old. And it seems kind of current to me. I ran across it the other day, almost surprised to find it. I wrote it right after the oil embargo in 1973. And I feel some obligation to begin today by setting the stage for why we're even talking about this at all. You will remember the oil embargo, I think, of those days. And at that time, we got pretty concerned all of a sudden about energy. It seemed to come on us very quickly, because we began to realize that at the rate we use oil in the world, we being our particular country, but everyone also, the way we use it, it's going to be gone pretty soon. Now, one can hear from time to time, in fact, I hear it an awful lot, that this is all a big scare, and don't worry about it. Everything's going to work out. We're going to find something else. And that's the way we've always operated, with a good optimistic mentality that we'll find something bigger and better and we won't have to change. I would suggest to you that even if we find something bigger and better, we ought to change anyway, and that we sure as the dickens aren't going to change the way we operate in the next 20 years, and by then we will be running out of oil. These are, if nothing else, transition times. In the year 2000, if we were allowed to use all the oil that the Arabs provide, with no other countries getting any of it, by the year 2000 it'll be gone. We now use 30% to 40% of the world's resources here in this land. This large land of ours. That's a big chunk. And I thought Charlie's description of a family dinner table with about 10 children, and when you pass the food around, if the first child or the first two children took 30% to 40% of the food, and by the time it got to the end, there wasn't very much left for those children, what would the father do? What would God think of that? We do sort of have an image of ourselves as being benevolent people. I would not want to destroy that. I think we are, in many ways, very charitable and generous people. We have to be realistic about what that means, though. When we talk about foreign aid to other countries, we're talking about 0.0001 of a percent. We're talking about 0.0005% of our gross national product is going to other nations. And portions, large portions of that, are military, things that we're sending to people, as well as loans that have interest due, which aren't gifts at all, loans only. So we have to be a little realistic about where we sit in the world. And it occurs to me that many of us think of ourselves as among the poor. I have, haven't you heard people talk about that? Oh, I'll read. Wealth, we say, rich, is other people with enough to spare, to spread around. I will not claim wealth. It requires responsibility, generosity, satisfaction, gratitude. I prefer striving, increasing, gaining, reaching for more, claiming I'm still so far behind the others. Today I shall pile upon my camel all my possessions, gifts, and talents, and count them one by one. Will my camel fit into the needle's tiny eye? I had a friend who felt all her life she was poor. That's what her family told her. So she, of course, if that's what she was told, that's what she believed. When she got married, she had 34 sweaters, and half of them were lamb's wool and cashmere. Her image was distorted by what she had been told. If we were to continue, if we were to change over to using coal rather than to depend solely on oil, the estimates are that where now we use 6 tons per capita, 1970, by the year 2020, we would be using 54 tons per capita of that fossil fuel. It is another one of those non-renewable resources. We joke about the fact that we could kill dinosaurs and start all over again, but you know the process takes a long time. So even coal and oil will not replace what we use in terms of petroleum. For me, in other words, the bottom line in much of this is the fact that we are running out of energy and resources. And it affects all of the world and not just ourselves. We live in a world in which there are powerful people and there are powerless people. We are the powerful. We understand that. Powerless people are the poor, very many of them hungry. From this book called Food, Fuel, and Future, let me read a couple of paragraphs. The powerless could grow enough food for themselves if they had control of their lands. But the problem is that foreign firms have bought up the lands. These lands previously grew citrus, bananas, and grains for local consumption. The colonial powers took over the land to grow cotton, rubber trees, sugar cane, and coffee, for example. In the Sahel, the African desert, natives were forced to give over even their marginal desert land to grow cotton for export and were forced to cultivate it. That destroyed the local agriculture know-how, which had produced food for local use up to that time. During the famine of the African Sahel in the early 70s, the export of grains for North European cattle feeding continued, and the export of cotton and peanuts increased. And that was in the midst of famine. And that was 1970. The distribution of food is a real problem for us, and how we use the land is crucial. And sometimes we're going to have to make some decisions, and we feel a little distant from these decisions, I think. Are we going to keep petroleum for ourselves to run our cars where we drive? I do it all the time, one person in the car all the time. Or are we going to allow some of those kinds of resources to go to places so that they can have one pump to pump enough water to go grow food for a whole village? It doesn't make sense the way we have it arranged now. The frustrating part of that is that most of us don't feel close enough to the power sources to make changes in that. And that's what we're going to talk about today. It's very difficult for us to, we think, affect the way Washington behaves, for example. I suggest to you, though, that if we could recognize who we are and deal with that first, and then work together, we could achieve some change. First of all, we would affect our economy. Secondly, we would feel better about who we are, about our own faith. It would be more consistent with what we claim to believe. That, to me, is a very great and powerful change. We are people who are consumers. It works for us. When you live in a land like this, that's the way we were built. We industrialize and we mass produce like crazy, and then you and I buy it all. And don't we love it? Where was the first place I went when I got here? A bookstore, you bet. Well, I took my luggage up first. All of it. We don't know how to live with less. Passing by the item in the store was difficult because it was on sale. Clearance. It grew large before me. All its uses, the unique design, the beautiful colors, and my desire to have, acquire, possess, purchase it grew to an emotion-charged pitch. I approached the sales clerk only to discover I could have two for even more savings. Two! I began to plot how I could use two, where I could store them, who I could tell, and to compliment myself on thrift and wisdom, being in the right place at the right time. Suddenly I knew, wrong place, wrong time. I didn't really need one. Certainly not two. I was trapped in bondage in a free country to the desire to have more and more, to satisfy my emotions rather than my real needs. I redefined. Wisdom was really my wanting, and my thrift was simple greed. I walked away. Wrong place, wrong time. Wrong reasons, wrong God. We smile at that among us because we've all been there. And the best way is not to go there. That's the best way to change. When I'm in school and working and all that stuff, I don't get out to the stores as often. It's the summer that's killing me right now. And I tried something. And you might like to try it. First of all, I would suggest all of you do this when you go home. Go open your closet door and count something. I don't care what it is. Count your shirts or your blouses or your pairs of shoes. You all have a weakness. Count that. Whatever it is, and see if you have enough. It's a neat thing to do because it's tangible. It awakens us a little bit. And last year, and I think it was the 1st of May, and now, I promised myself I wouldn't buy any clothes for a year except lingerie, stockings. I always go through stockings, that kind of stuff. And I knew I would need a pair of shoes for school. So I said, I won't do that. See if I could do it. I did real well. You know that? I did, but I was short a month. The truth is I made it 11 months, and then spring was here, and I honestly needed some slacks for spring. But it was a very interesting experiment to discover that one could do that. And you know what it's done to me now. It's really hard now. once you begin to make those kinds of personal changes and experiments, you begin to realize more about who you are and what you're doing. Hard to change back. We are descendants of pioneer travelers who saw open land and limitless space as something to be overcome, to be subdued, to be filled. Blessed with much, they took it, used it. We, like they, expect to find more space, more trees, more water, more things. We claim our territory, our section of land, and demand our privacy, our personal space, although it is no longer limitless, but a luxury. We expect wilderness to survive without planning. We consume voraciously ignoring the needs of posterity. We buy bigger and add on, expand, and then we fill our extra space with things and wonder that we use so much energy replacing things and making more. Jesus understood that life is simple. It's relationships, love and anger, cooperation and listening and time. Space and separateness are not superior to knowing each other better. Space is a luxury of temporary withdrawal. Life is love close together. We don't live very close together. We close our bedroom door when we don't want to see anybody for a while. One time we traveled and we were, well, maybe here you're experiencing that too. You know, you all get kind of, you get into the same little piece of space for a certain period of time and you work it out because you can't run away. Maybe that's what we ought to be doing. Maybe that's healthy lifestyle as opposed to being so independent from one another. We are the pleasure seekers. We pay good money to be entertained. We just built this domed stadium in Minneapolis. It's just disgusting. I mean, I like sports, but it really kind of got me down. We have hyped this so much that I notice in my children, one more than the other, there is a genuine need for constant activity almost. And it's a built-in, it's an addiction like sugar. He has that too. To have to keep filling that self up. We lose some of our creativity that way. We could look at it as a loss, I suppose. How do we change all that? I'd like to suggest a lot of different ways. I've written them all in the ones I'll use in poetry. So I'll use them as I've written them. I'm sure that many of you have tried different things, and maybe we're going to have a chance to talk about that as we move into it. I think maybe one of the first things we have to come to grips with is that driving. We do a class at Richfield Lutheran, which is where I work, in changing lifestyles, we call it. I think I'm going to change it to call it Better Futures. But at any rate, when I have the people come in, they play a game of bingo, and they go around and try to find the people who've had an inexpensive party lately. After all, sandwiches and soup are just as good as a great big, in fact, they're a whole lot better if you're the cook than a great big dinner party, because after all, the real stuff happens sitting at the table when you're done eating anyway. So who's done that? Who hangs out the laundry? And who is in a carpool? You know, we never have bingo, because nobody ever has that checked. And we've run, oh, I don't know, 100 people through that course in the last couple years. They don't do it. It seemed like a hassle, a carpool. Sublimating independence, planning ahead, locating riders. But necessity dictated, and we learned a new way. Morning is now friendly, and afternoon relaxing, as we ride together, talk and joke, share the driving, hassle less traffic. We exchanged independence for friendship, and we've come out ahead. If we could enter with that attitude, it might help. We don't carpool to church either, do we? That wouldn't be hard to do. How about a carpool Sunday at church? Why not? The water runs as I wash and rinse dishes, as I am distracted, as I linger in the shower. The water runs, the heat dissipates, the liquid disappears. I saw the library poster. All the water on earth is all the water there is. Some people have water contaminated and restricted. I have water heated, handy, fresh, and pure. All the water on earth is all the water there is. Turn my mind on and the water off, unless I really need it. I have a friend who was part of these groups who, it's hard to do too, because we live in Minnesota. She, you know, she does this thing where, like the Swedes do. Turns on the water, gets all wet, turns it off, soaps up. When she's all lathered up, turns on the water and rinses it off. You know, she uses a lot less than the rest of us. It's kind of a neat idea. The whole thing about leaving the water, well, maybe you use dishwashers, I don't know, but the leaving the water on all the time while we're rinsing, you know, stack it on, rinse it after. Put the things in the dishwasher, if you're going to use the dishwasher, run it through the cycle, turn it off before it gets to dry so that you save the electricity, open the door and let the humidity come into the house, especially in the winter. That's very useful and helpful. Use the dishwasher only once in a day or 2 days, you know, get it full before it happens, before you use it. Small things. But every one of them is a mark that I am concerned. Every time you reinforce that conviction, that attitude, you are telling yourself again that I believe in this. I believe I ought not be wasteful. I believe that this belongs to other people as well as to me. The earth is meant to be my home, comfort, protection. God's world loves me, rocks me in natural rhythms, caresses me with breezes, feeds me with air and plants, soothes me with snow, and warms me with sun. I have forgotten, distracted by alien structures and forbidding concrete. I need the earth. I need its love more than I need man-made stone. There will be times when we shall have to speak and say, let's not build anymore. We had all we could do to save the Boundary Waters canoe area in Minnesota. Huge job, because people want to use it. People want to possess it. People want to take their aggressions out in snowmobiles and go over and conquer. We are a conquering kind of people. We operate that way. And we fill it up. I see it in myself sometimes. If I like it, my next natural impulse is to say, I want to have it. I want to possess it. And this even goes with human relationships, I think. Someone who is attractive, we want to get close to. We want to possess some of their time. We drive out in the country, and this has surely been true in Minneapolis. I was driving one day to speak in a, well, I don't know what you call this, but it's a town, it's not a suburb, but it's just the next step out, and there's a little farmland in between. And I have this sense that people have settled out there because they wanted to get out to the land. And so what did they do? They bought it up, and they lost it. It's gone. So it was a red barn that stands alongside the road, and there it is all by itself. And then here's this whole housing development all around. They lost the land they were going to have. It's part of our humanness to think that we shall possess life and all of its things and the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. It's been a throwaway world. Disposable diapers, tableware, cups, shavers, dressing gowns, pop cans, bed pans, tissues. Cast-offs creating landfills, landfills of luxury. Soon it became pervasive, cast-off people, disposable values, replaceable nature. Shall we yet throw away all that is dear, or will we cling to lasting life-giving values, people, love, sharing, earth, God? And don't you know, I had to have a bag to carry my things in. What's it made of? Plastic, don't you think? Plastic, which requires the chemicals made from petroleum that could be used for fertilizer. Plastic is really we want to think twice about plastic, don't we? Whether we want to use that stuff. Even those darn leaf bags that are so convenient because they don't get wet, I just have this image of these dumps, and someday they're going to open up all this land, you know, and it's just going to be covered with all these layers of brown and green plastic. It won't have disappeared at all. It'll still be there. You know, a great gift to our great-grandchildren. And I get angry about this, you know. That was a plastic bottle. Of course it won't break. So it's better than glass then, perhaps. And I can't believe that in a time of energy crisis and awareness that companies have made the decision to go to plastic bottles. It just is incomprehensible to me. When glass can be recycled and plastic cannot. You can't even get your 3 cents, what is it now, a dime, 20 cents back on these bottles. One of our other problems, I think, is, as long as we're on packaging, let's just talk for a second about packaging. I brought a couple things with me. We teach this class at Richfield. I would be happy to share with you some of the materials. And one of the things we look at is the kind of packaging we have. Now this little, we won't give the brand name, but this is one of those things where you can have individual portions of food, in this case soup. The price of this, I get 4 envelopes of soup. And the price on here was 85 cents. For 4 bowls, cups really, 4 cups of soup. It isn't even economical. But it's convenient. We like speed and efficiency and convenience. We are slaves to those things. And so we pay, not only financially, but we pay in our use of energy to make a product like that. Sugar smacks, or frosted flakes, or any of them. If you could read the ingredients, what's the first ingredient that would be listed?
Sure.
Because it is the most prevalent ingredient in this particular product. They always list the largest one first. So we have to read our boxes, I guess. Did you ever read a Dream Whip box? Oh, it's just awful. Do it if you haven't done it sometime. Pick up Dream Whip and see if you buy it. Within the program that we started at the church, we used Food, Fuel, and Future, that book I showed you, which is divided into a 5-week course of about 2 hours each. I wrote a supplement to it based on what we've learned from the experience. Occasionally, this has seemed heavy-handed. It has seemed scolding sometimes to some people. People are sensitive in different ways. And we liked the experience of being together and talking about what was happening with us. That whole, every time I bring up that idea about the dishwasher, I think of Shelley, because Shelley always opens her dishwasher and lets that electricity turn off. And Shelley's absolutely a proselytizer. She talks to the whole neighborhood. And she has started using only 1 tank of gas a month. And she started using a tank of gas every 2 weeks. And then she pushed it a little farther and a little farther. And then when she runs out, she doesn't drive. Ooh, that's great self-limiting stuff. And when people begin to share that, they gain from each other. They gain support and encouragement and new ideas. As we worked through this, which is a tie between energy and hunger, out of it came groups on job transition. Do you find in your congregations a lot of people are beginning to lose jobs? We're seeing it more and more. We tend to be a middle, definitely middle, and maybe lower middle class group of people. More and more people are unemployed or having to move from one job to another. So we started a support group for that purpose. Our hunger task force took us from, now this is a large congregation, so we're like 2,600 adults, took us from giving a couple $1,000s a year to World Hunger up to like 13,000, I think would be our goal this year, over and above regular benevolence giving. The awareness is growing within the group. And so I would recommend to you that this is something you could start. Do a forum on it or something, first of all, to attract some people, or call some specific people who you know are interested in this kind of thing. Ask them to sit down with you and go through it. It can be led by lay leaders. They have a program guide. It contains a couple of film strips which are useful. The supplement, which I wrote, if you're serious about wanting to use it, I would be happy to give you one of these supplements that talks about all kinds of different ways to present the material. Takes some of the biting edge off some of the material. It helps explain some of it that we thought was harder to work with, and expands it with a lot of ideas, money-saving tips, and so on. That's how people got interested. Money-saving tips. Self-interest is what brought people to the class. We said to people, it's obvious the economy is changing. It's obvious we can't afford heat as we used to. I want to tell you, your heat bills, if you live where we live, are just going to go right out the ceiling in the next 5 years. Oh, we're so blissful about it. And so we began to see the real needs were right there, and we said to people, would you like to have a class in this? We called it Changing Lifestyles. You might want to call it Better Futures. And they were interested. And what happened was we came wanting to help our own selves, and we ended up understanding that the rest of the world was in a lot worse trouble than we were. Attitude is the underlying basis of this. Let me share a number of things about attitude that I think they're Christian, they're basic to our faith, and then we'll open it up for some talk. We talk here at Holden quite a bit about limits. I've always resisted limits, diets, discipline. They're hard to maintain. Well, it's the same old story. People rebel against God and rationalize, resist, take the forbidden fruit. Yet I know I need limits. Everybody does. We aren't comfortable when we overindulge. I mean, how do you feel when you get up from the table after that, after Thanksgiving? This rite that we perform, do you understand that? That we are so thankful that we fill ourselves up to being stuffed. That doesn't even add up. It isn't even grateful. We aren't comfortable when we overindulge and act wastefully, rationalize, or overlook injustice. Perhaps we are afraid of ourselves and what untempered desire can do to the world and to us. As our lives simplify and we peel away excess, we may discover God's fruits of life, firm and sweet, limited, but good. All those cherries, huh? That made me think of those cherries we've been enjoying. Would they be so good if you had them every day? Mm-mm. How many of you in your congregations have had refugees come in? Well, that's a pretty good number. Quite a few have come to Minnesota. We have, we've had difficulty, in fact, now recently placing new refugees coming in. And I do hear people talking, well, I don't know, they're going to take our jobs, you know, that kind of stuff. For decades, immigrants came to our welcoming shores. They worked, learned, developed this land. Refugees bringing desire and strength. We are diverse and strong because they came. Now that we have so much, let us look back in gratitude and welcome more immigrants. New people offering greater diversity and additional strengths. We do not choose to keep only for ourselves. We choose to share because we have much, and it is right to give refugees a home. One of the things that helps us change is to have what we call replacement values. One of our fellows described it this way. If you've been a smoker all your life, and you decide to take up jogging, you have always valued being able to smoke. You like it. It's a pleasure for you. When you begin to jog and you begin to find that a pleasure, perhaps a competing pleasure, and it begins to feel good, then you have a decision to make. One value is in conflict with the other. You replace one value with another. You replace the pleasure of having cigarettes with the pleasure of feeling healthy. That's a replacement value. If we could enter many of the things of our future this way, I think we could do it more successfully. When I feel like I'm giving up the things that make me happy, I need to remember I can be happy in different ways by choosing other things. I pay the doctor less because I choose to jog more and eat better. I find status not from having a big car, but from having a small one. I used to love a big hotel, Now I prefer camping. I feel more joy on my bike than in a car. Once I liked all new. Now I kind of enjoy making do. Replacing values reduces the need to feel deprived. I can replace consumption with conservation. Rehabilitation with prevention. Self-indulgence with sharing. And self-centeredness with God. I'm not extravagant, but I've had dreams, plans for my future. Now, I can really identify with this one. I don't know if you can or not. A golden flower would unfold, possessions, security, travel. Well, we could add so much to that, retirement. I'm disappointed because my future won't be as I've hoped. Rather, I will live with less. My goal, my flower, is tarnished. Disappointment is natural, but bitterness is vain. Clinging to dreams while ignoring present joys or new horizons could foolishly consume my energy. I shall design other goals. Set aside tarnished gold, which was more cosmetic than real. My new flower can be a fragrant, living, beautiful creation of God, rooted in trust more than security, and in living rather than gold. That element of trust is one of the theological concepts that we need to be talking about more. Trusting God, trusting change. I think we do trust things. We do trust being able to have retirement plans. That's what's scaring everybody about Social Security and all this stuff. We got to thinking that we could figure out a way to take care of everything. Maybe we can't. We have to put our trust back in those things greater than ourselves. I've been tripping over guilt these days. I know the truth of overindulgence and underdevelopment and hunger and exploitation of the powerless and the temptation to want to forget all that and keep everything for ourselves. Guilt catches my step, and then I sprawl awkwardly in the mud of selfishness. Well, stand up, clean up. God puts me back on my feet, forgiven. I'm not perfect, had I thought I was. I'm washed clean and left with a job to do, to notice, to share, to conserve, to preserve, to care while walking humbly with my God. The subtitle to this is a study program on just and humble lifestyles. The bishop of the LCA recently made a statement that I appreciated a lot. He said, we talk, and particularly now our president refers a lot to charity, that charity will continue. We will continue to be charitable even though it isn't coming from the federal government, etc. And the bishop reminds us that there's a difference between charity and justice. It's one thing to give a little something to somebody, and it's another thing to give them the privilege of doing it for themselves, of having justly been placed in the order of things. To keep for ourselves and then give a token is not the same as to share. Hunger, what do I know of hunger? Temporary pangs between meals. I mean, we can't even get past that because we have 10 o'clock coffee. Hunger saps strength and energy, brain power, the will to live. Lord, it is a sin that your creatures, any of them, should lack the will to live, your great gift, because they're hungry while others are overfed. Even though grocery prices are higher, I am still fed. There are things I can do and learn to help change this world, to feed the many, to share. But it's a complicated job, and so I delay or deny or idly hope. The job, the people wait for me. Lord, we do not lack the strength. We lack the will. And so I harp at my children, and I say, we've got to keep this car another couple years. We're not going to buy a new one just to have a new one. And we insulate and insulate and insulate in our part of the country. And we begin to think about buying things differently. Do we need coffee? We have a very prominent family in our congregation that grows flowers. And they're nationally known. And they discovered, much to their dismay, one of them is in the Hunger Task Force, this one couple, and she was describing what was happening in Colombia. It seems that Colombia has made into a cash crop carnations. Now, they took land that peasants used to use to eat off of to grow carnations for us. This lady was reading this in the book, and there it was, the name of her company, importing all of those carnations. She said, I practically fell out of bed. But that, you see, that's profitable. That's just kind of the way the system works. And it's detrimental to these people who are hungry. And so we have to ask, do we need to buy all that coffee all the time? Or should we pay so little for it, perhaps? Do we need all that sugar? We know how harmful it is to us. Shall we continue to buy sugar and deplete the land of those Caribbean countries? Is it right? Is it something we ought to talk to each other about? Maybe you and I can't change that policy, but could we talk to each other about that? Again, food, fuel, and future would be a starting place. How about the practice that we have of sending beef cattle to some other countries to be fed, to grow beef for our fast food chains? How about that? There's a lot we can do. And if I'm going to teach my kids how to do it, I figure it's very important for them to learn the land. The whole world's going to belong to them very soon, right? So I get after them, turn off the lights, right? Turn off the shower, you're in there too long. I want to teach my children lasting values, Christian, caring, unselfish, and kind. And I'm impatient when they beg for more things or leave the lights burning. How do I persuade children, present-day people, that tomorrow will reflect today, that blessed people are to be good stewards, and that people are more important than things? I teach them by example. Buying less or delaying purchases, contrasting profit with people motives, repairing, recycling, spending time with them, playing games, rejoicing in what we have rather than complaining about our lack. I must expect no more of them than I expect of myself. We'll finish up with just one more poem, and then I would like to open it up to you if you have ideas or questions about changing our lifestyle. I stripped a piece of furniture to its natural wood, removed layers of shiny varnish and the dirt and dust of years of use. The wood beneath was fine, solid, true. I stripped my life of its unnecessary varnishes. I kept my family and closest friends. A simple home. Basic food. Knowledge that I'm able to contribute to the world. A part of God's plan, my reason to live. And stripped of all those other things. Lobster with melted butter. Matching end tables. A boat and a new car. And a ring to remember our anniversary. The substance remained fine, solid, true, unvarnished, and good. So, what would you like to share?
Grow, and you're specifically saying this is an area and it's not just sort of a block cut on anything.
And I think that's an important consideration. As long as that is being regulated, then perhaps we will be okay. Only the wood that should be cut will be used. Regulation here is an important word. We hear a lot of talk about deregulating a lot of things. We have to look carefully at which things do we want to deregulate. There are some things for our own protection we need to control, and that would be one of them, the use of our resources.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things you mentioned, when you start talking about doing things along the community, you start in with some businesses that say, hey, that's jobs. You know, you mentioned Boundary Waters. Hey, they got great big commercial, you know, the tourism up there. Things like plastic bottles. A few years ago in the legislature, there was talking about the returnable things, like Iowa has a bison can thing. And my local community came up in arms against any kind of a can ban, a can bill, because one of the bigger industries happens to make those things. And people are really scared of their jobs, particularly in this time.
And that's, this whole employment thing will be increasingly difficult for us. And it does make us self-interested. And it's very hard to keep our eye over the whole big picture as we are one of the people going through the transition. That's pretty tough. It will be perhaps possible, though, to do, if we're willing to do this, to do more job sharing. It means, well, we're seeing some of this already in the unions. If it means that more people can work less time, we may just do it, and we can hope for that kind of thing. Those things are really kind of hopeful to me. Yes?
It's less sugar. You know, that land will not be returned to them, probably, as they know it, or will they be able to use it if they ever get it back, ever, but corporations will find something else to do with the land.
Yes, we wouldn't want to be too simplistic about our answers. However, I wouldn't encourage us to continue to eat sugar anyway. It would be all right to stop eating sugar and then hope for and work for some changes in land distribution and ownership. We see that happening within the Christian Church in Central America. The more we could learn about that, and I would recommend to you a man here by the name of Jerry Folk, F-O-L-K, and one coming into the village named Glenn Leaf, L-E-A-F. Both of them know a lot about Central America. And what has been happening, where some land has been given back to, for example, in Nicaragua, to peasants, and managed very well. And we're getting two stories. We get a State Department story, and we get a Christian story that comes not only from our ALC people, but from the Catholic Church, which is having renewal in all these areas. And those kinds of political considerations will enter in. I don't usually try to get into that because, first, I'm not well enough informed. And secondly, it makes me feel again more distant. And so I just was dealing with the tangible aspect of the sugar. But you're right, you can't jump from sugar to free land for peasants. That isn't going to happen. Yes?
The book that you were quoting from available?
There, my books are in the bookstore.
I'd like to have one.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We talk about simplifying life, and how are we going to do it, and it's very difficult to do. And I have a suggestion as to what would make people change their lifestyles, and probably nobody here will take me up on it. when we hear about developing countries, and we hear about people going there, and the sociologists, at least, tell us about the horrible culture shock you will get when you go to a foreign country and stay there, not like a hop, skip, jump tourist. Well, I have spent 4 years in a developing country in Africa and 4.5 in the South Pacific in a developing country. And I found that the culture shock of going into one of those countries is as nothing compared to the culture shock of coming back here. I've been back since the end of 78, and I am not over it. I never will be. You go into those countries. Well, you think about families around here. Once in a while, I hear somebody saying, oh, I don't know what I'm going to have for supper tonight. You know, we had thus and so leftovers. My husband won't eat leftovers, or my kids won't eat leftovers, and so on. And this bothers me, not this leftover thing, but our eating habits bother me, especially at times like Thanksgiving and Christmas, when people go around and say, I wonder what we should have to eat this year, forgetting that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are not saying, I wonder what we'll have to eat this year. Every day they are saying, I wonder if I'll have anything to eat.
Keep talking.
And you live in a country like that. Well, I had an advantage that a lot of Americans don't have. Mm-hmm. This last stint of 4.5 years, I was in Papua New Guinea. And I was teaching at a teacher's college, and I worked with students who went out to the villages for their student teaching. And you always had to have one teacher going with them, and I enjoyed it, so I volunteered. But I went out there, and one of the times I went, I slept on a mat on the floor for 3 weeks. I used their kind of outdoor toilets. I washed in a pail of water that they brought in from the river in the morning and evening. They wash twice a day, and certainly I should do it too. I had a diet a couple times I was in banana country. Not our kind of bananas, but bananas for cooking. And they eat bananas every single day. And they could imagine that I would like bananas too. Yeah, one morning for breakfast, what did they get? 6 of these dark orange red bananas cooked for my breakfast, plus hot water for tea. And you eat it every day. If you're in another section, you get what's called cow-cow, and people say it's sweet potato. It isn't. It's pale yellow and very delicate flavor. They eat it every day. And you well know that their one meal comes about 4 in the afternoon. If the children have breakfast, they go feel around in the ashes. Is there a leftover sweet potato from yesterday? If there are enough of them, so there are 2 per child, they eat one and take the other one along to school for school lunch, or they don't have any school lunch. And then you come back here where people, it's horrible.
It's hard, and it's very hard, first of all, for you to adapt. It's very difficult not to be real judgmental about that. And it's very difficult for people living in the middle of it to know what it is to live outside of it, especially people who've never lived any other way. And the more consciousness raising we can do along that line, I think, the better. And there is hunger here. There is hunger here. And if we can also see it, if we look.
I don't like it that ALC calls this hunger appeal. They should call it starvation. People over in Somalia, starving.
And migrant workers in the United States are neither paid well nor fed well. And if one were to go to Appalachia, you'd find the same kind of thing. So we have it here if we want to see it. I really think we're choosing not to. Yeah.
I just wanted to sort of give a personal anecdote of another fast of the difficulty. A year ago, my husband and I were married at age 28. And at that point in time, both of us have been very independent and haven't had many things in terms of the traditional kinds of wedding gifts, didn't feel like we needed them. We're going to put on our wedding invitation that we preferred people not give us gifts, that we felt we didn't need a lot of the kinds of things that are traditional. And met such intense resentment from both sets of parents that we sort of tried to word of mouth convey that to as many people as we could. A particular concern we had was the desire not to get a number of appliances. And those that we did get were the first things we tried to exchange whenever possible. But I'm very concerned with that whole consumerism too. And I think as you talked about some of the things within your own home, I thought about our concerns about, you know, the television, radio, stereos, blenders, the whole thing that is certainly espoused as the ideal American home.
And if we were to count, I think they say an average home has 21 small appliances. You might want, that's another thing to count when you get home. Let me just, I think I need to wrap up so we keep our time, but I want to mention one thing that Charlie said yesterday, Charlie Mays, if you heard him. gee, there are a lot of good people here this week. I sat in that meeting the other day, yesterday, and thought, wow. He talked about judgment, that we live in a time and we accept for ourselves, and I think I see that in your faces, our own judgment on ourselves as to how we live. And we know that that judgment comes from outside ourselves as well. God's judgment must surely be there. I think we'd be hard put denying that. Judgment, however, is the very important first step. One does not repent until you have come under judgment. You can't change until you recognize what you need to change. We don't need to be afraid to say that we're not perfect. There is no nation that is perfect. There is no system that is perfect, no economic or political system, and there's no human being either. And when we can say, this is my fault, this is my failure, this is my weakness, then we have an opportunity to become closer to God. It seems to me it's the most marvelous time to be alive for that reason. That we could despair at the use of resources and at the way the world is going, or we can say to ourselves, now we have come face to face with opportunity to change. They were trying to change something in their lives. It wasn't easy, but it was worth it. It was consistent with what they believed. If we live for what we believe, then we are living a life that has some meaning. And for me, that would be very important.